The film didn't stay in focus, started late, the sound was horrible, there was a real pall over the room, you know, where's Harvey, is Harvey, you know, we're running, you know, just like kind of, as soon as he arrives, it's like, you can tell that there was not a real pleasant atmosphere. The first 15 minutes of the movie felt interminable. At this particular screening, and it turns out that, you know, after a long day that was not really a particularly pleasant one, the chairman pretty much bolted from the big leather seat in the back and left at the exact same point that I had taken out the tape first time round. So it turns out, you know, I took a bunch of friends and my brother's a couple years younger than I am to have drinks, and, you know, it became clear that the people who liked the movie, it was a real love-hate. You know, people either like found the movie to be offensive or repugnant or whatnot, and the people who did stick it out felt that understood what I guess Scott had said the first time I met him, that that it's a vulgar thinking man's film. So the people who stuck around seemed to really enjoy it, and so I guess you know, once the chairman's passed on the movie, it's pretty difficult to get a you know, to convince him otherwise. But John was involved at this point. We're getting alerted to what was happening with who else was seeing the movie and what his plans were to hopefully close a deal prior to Sundance and focus on Go Fish at the festival. So come Sundance, I see Kevin and Scott the first night, and they, at this point, like, you know, I've been like the middleman between the filmmakers and you know, my bosses. I've tried to pierce the corporate armor at this point and get the movie you know, into our slate of films prior to the festival, but that wasn't happening. So I took a little bit more activist stance than I would at a festival when people say, oh, what are you interested in? What are you looking at? What do you like? Usually it's, you know, I have some sort of curt response that will deflect them, but this time around I decided, well, maybe I can contribute to the buzz of the movie a little bit. You know, try to get journalists that I'm familiar with to have a look at the film and maybe build a little momentum. So I would say Clerks, go see Clerks.
Okay, Mark, I wanted to just stop you for a moment to go back a little bit before Sundance, before we go into this festival story. Bob, tell us a little bit about your sort of feelings about Clerks after the initial screening.
For me, I can enjoy a movie on a surface level as entertaining, but what I'm always looking for and hoping that happens is that a movie has hauntability. And it means also that there's something there underneath the laughs. And I found from the time I saw Clerks, it haunted me. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized how much it spoke to needs that we all have, and that there was a lot going on underneath the foul mouth sex talk, which is causing the MPAA to give it an NC-17, where there are movies with blood gushing out and 1,000 fuckins in the dialogue that get ours. But anyway, so I asked to write the program note because I was passionate about the film, and I wanted to write about what it meant to me, and I'm just going to quote from my last paragraph. I said, Kevin Smith's affection for his characters informs an essentially serious work that refuses to take itself seriously. The laughs are immediate. The aftertaste is poignant and haunting. And I think that by the time of Sundance, I was so happy that Clerks was going to have a chance, because I realized it was more than just a lot of laughs. And and this age thing, I'm 56 years old, so I'm thought of as an old fart. I'm not Mark Tusk anymore. But what Clerks is about is across the board, all of the vulgarity and the blowjob jokes and fucking a corpse and all that is. Oh, I'm sorry. It's a certain. It's a coping mechanism to deal with all of our horniness, which is also yearning, our sexual horniness and our intellectual and spiritual horniness. And what it is that we are all yearning. And so, for me, by the time of Sundance, Clerks have become a lot more to me, so more important that it be appreciated and respected.
Thank you. John Sloss, maybe you could tell us when you got involved with Kevin and Scott and what your first kind of impressions of the film and them.
Before I get started, I'd like to ask a question. Is everyone up here really
lucky? Uh-huh. You wish.
There's your answer. There it is. Testing. I got involved through John Pearson. I had worked with John on Slacker, on the distribution deal on Slacker with Rick Linkletter, and John's been a friend of mine for a long time. After he got involved in the film, I had heard about it. I'm not sure through whom. It might have been directly through John. And I called him up and said, I heard good things about this film. What's the deal? These guys have a lawyer, being the predator that I am. And he said, what did you, do you remember what you said?
There was some customer at the Quick Stop that was advising them, I think.
Yeah, right. Fools. You should have stuck with it. I forget, somehow I got a hold of the tape, and I actually watched the tape with Rick Linkletter, who happened to be up from Texas. We were working on a deal. I don't know whether we were either in the middle of Dazed and Confused or working on the next deal. And we both liked it a lot, and I called John. I said, God, I'd really like to meet these guys. I've taken greater and lesser involvements doing distribution on films, but when John's involved, it's really necessary and best to sort of step back and, if you're a lawyer, sort of function as a lawyer. That's really what I did. I met these guys, and I guess they really liked me. It's a Sally Field
you
of the
like
panel.
Me. You really like me.
You've got it. Before Sundance, I was working with him, and we went out to Sundance. And at the point, I don't want to get ahead of. Are we going to get to the point where Harvey? Yeah. Well.
One moment.
Believe it or not, that's the extent of my involvement up until the point we are on the panel, and. Maybe
we'll
I have a little
back.
More to say in a little bit.
All right, so Kevin and Scott, tell us, how you were feeling kind of approaching the festival and at the kind of in the early parts of the festival about the chances.
Well, nobody retold the story of how after the screening at Miramax, a phone call came down the line from Mark. It was a message was misunderstood, and we were led to believe that we were in play at Miramax. So we spent about the most joyous 24 hours of our life. And then when it came down the line, it wasn't true. We spent the worst 24 hours of our life. And knowing that all the distributors had seen it already, we really didn't know what to expect.
The message was that there's good news and there's bad news, but we really should talk about it later. And the good news was that the staff and the young people and the people who stuck it out really liked the movie. The bad news, of course, was that the main decision maker didn't. But the irony of this was that they were running around with Rick Linkletter that night, one trying to figure out where I was so we could all hang out and be joyous, but probably was a blessing in disguise.
We're also putting a competitive pressure on, because we were actually at the Sony screening room watching Far Away So Close, so that the first 15 minutes of Clerks were interminable, we had 2.5 interminable hours.
Okay, so Kevin, just give us a kind of narrative of the first few days at Sundance.
Sundance wasn't bad. It was the first time we had a real audience, and it was a packed audience, and the first screening was great. And we didn't do a Q&A or anything like that because it was too late. And the second screening was on a morning. It was a 10 o'clock in the morning screening. It was snowing, so we didn't think anyone would be there. But they did show up, and that was packed, and once again, it was great. But up to that point, that was it. We just had great screenings, and all the distributors had seen it by then, so we didn't think, you know, I mean, this was it. This was Sundance would be the beginning of a festival route, and we travel festivals, never get bought, and that would be it.
You didn't really feel that way, did you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, like, all the distributors had seen it at that point, and John was busy with Go Fish, so, you know, we were just like, John likes the girls better than us. Why can't we be lesbians? You know, so... There was 5 days of, you know, it was great to have the good screenings, but nothing had happened. And then the fifth day, all of a sudden, it turned around, and the buzz from the previous two screenings just brought all the press towards us, and people started, like, stopping us on the street and quoting lines from the movie. It was a weird kind of experience.
Again, comment on us? Okay. First of all, it's true, I abandoned them utterly and completely in their first screening because we made a strategy going into Sundance where no distributor had seen Go Fish ahead of time, that Go Fish was going to be sold within the first 48 hours on the basis of its first screening. And so I devoted myself to that pretty much exclusively, and that's what came to pass on Go Fish. It was actually less than 48 hours. So then it was turning to Clerks. And the screening had gone really well. And the second screening, the Monday morning's 10 a.m. snowy screening, actually had a tremendous press turnout. What they had to say about the film didn't get into print for a couple of days. Karen James from the New York Times, the trade reviews, these things were Dave Kerr in the Daily News, called it a cross between Howard Stern and David Mamet. These were really key things that really brought distributors' attention back around. So I wasn't actually that worried about it at that point, and I would have conveyed more of a sense of confidence maybe in Kevin if I'd known. One demonstration of how I felt pretty good about it is that a writer from the Chicago Tribune named Jessica Siegel asked if she could kind of follow this film around as the deal went down. And I don't think if I thought there was any grave doubt about things turning out well, I would have said yes, she could, and she did, and fortunately, you know, we wound up with the perfect dramatic ending. So you want to pick that up again, or
I'm going
to keep.
Well, Kevin, the question was whether you were going to get Harvey back to a screening and how that was going to happen. So, Mark, tell us a little bit about how you saw it at that point from your standpoint inside Miramax.
Let's see. It didn't. You know, it seemed like that from critics talking about the movie, that and audiences, that it was causing a bit of a stir, and of course. I guess Reality Bites was on screens at that time, or was it the festival?
It was going to debut there.
It was playing there, so there was all this talk about, like, you know, 20-somethings and Generation X, and, you know, I'd always thought that, like, you've heard me say this before, like, Generation X was, you know, a punk band from the days when Billy Idol actually mattered, and you know, so I wasn't buying that, and I never really jived much to Beavis and Butthead yet, but all these comparisons were, like, cropping to the surface, and, so like I said, I was making it both tapping critics' thoughts on the film, see if there's going to be any chance that I can, revive interest in-house, and also suggesting that they take a look at the movie. And so it turns out that Harvey reappeared for the second half of Sundance and had spoken to some critics, and there were little blurbs that had surfaced in the New York papers by that point, and his interest was revived. And so there was one final public screening before the last day of Sundance, they repeat the favorites, but no one, you know, was banking on that yet. So it got down to, like, will Harvey go? Will we get Harvey to the screening? Will Harvey, you know, stay for the screening? And all this attention on my boss. And so, of course, he comes to the screening. Some of the other distributors thought it was a bit peculiar that I was being thanked from the stage without having really concluded any deal at that point. But And needless to say, he thought it was a bit peculiar too. But and things seemed to be going pretty well. The audience was into the movie, and he began twitching at that same point that we had trouble overcoming before. And at this point, I said, and I was like, Harvey, the movie's about to kick into gear. Just stick around. Remember, think of the movie, the number 37. Anyway, so it turns out, like, you know, he got it. You know, the movie was playing really well. There were times where you could hear him laughing more uproariously than anyone in the place. And I guess we, you know, left the theater, went right across the street to you know, talk about the deal with David Lindy, who was in our international sales department, had run acquisitions and was going to do this deal. Well, of course, this is the same restaurant that Bob Hawke is sitting at with eating. I don't know who it was with, and of course, Bob is kind of like, occasionally we're like catching glances. Probably took about, I don't know, half hour, 40 minutes. Harvey made it perfectly clear his enthusiasm for the film. This was over a couple orders of, I guess,
potato skins,
and which if you stick it out for the credits, this will make some sense to people afterwards. But the potato skin reference, that is. Well, so I don't know, half hour, 40 minutes later, basic deal terms are concluded. He leaves, and we're left with David, myself, John, Kevin, and Scott, and. Where was John at this point?
Yeah, John was at
a
party.
Where the hell was our lawyer, man?
He was at the reality bite screen.
I was tending to a couple of less well cared for clients.
Well, they were in good hands with John, and we ended up.
Yeah, I just want to say I think my presence was felt though. let's get this deal done before Sloss gets here.
Well, it turns out that it was. You know, we on a, I guess single page of a yellow, you know, legal pad. We wrote out the agreement. Everybody was all thrilled. We're, you know, walking away. I don't know. We were going to get a bottle of champagne, and we're walking away. And I hear Scott say to Kevin, or Kevin say to Scott, like, "Wow, we'll really be able to pay our deferments now." And there's a odd thrill in that. And you know, from one moment it was like, well, the movie was a pass, and we weren't going to be doing anything. And the next thing you know. We're committed to having the film open in, you know, 50 markets and or 50 cities or 50 screens or I don't know what it was, but needless to say, it was kind of a heady experience for everyone involved, and if it doesn't work, well, just blame the marketing people. At this point, I've done my thing, but it was. I guess where do we pick up from now?
Well, I just want to get Kevin and Scott's impression of this post screening sequence of the. Going over there in the meeting itself.
It was kind of bizarre because, like, you know, John was there and Mark was there, and in, like, a matter of, like, 10 minutes, we went from being minimum wage slaves to making more money than Mark Tusk, and that was pretty hot. But
not very difficult.
Really, surprisingly not difficult. But it was...
I just love the movies.
It was a bizarre experience. It was, like, the best screening we had at Sundance. And then... we had this Q&A, and it was a really long Q&A, and then Scott came over, because Gwen from Go Fish was like, Pearson wants you to cross the street, because Harvey's over there, and so Scott's trying to get me, and I'm talking to some guy there, and Scott's like pushing the guy out of the way, so like, that was the first fan I think we ever pissed off, and then we went across the street, and they're there, and Harvey's like, it's kind of weird sitting down with Harvey, he's just like this true vulgarian. And I don't know if maybe it was the film that brought it out, but, man, he was throwing around the word fuck, like, more times than Eddie Murphy. It was nuts, and he was just like, we're the fucking company that broke the fucking piano and the fucking Crying Game. I'm like, fuck yeah, you want to buy my fucking film? So, it was a good experience. I mean, you know, it's the best experience you can have with Harvey. You don't want him mad at you, but if you want him saying fucking all happy and stuff.
It was really great to have John there because, I mean, we were like, our eyes were wide open and our mouths were on the floor. And, I mean, Harvey could have been like, I'll give you $10. And we would have been like, we'll take it. We'll.
So, John, how did you shepherd it through?
Well, one micro detail that's sort of been alluded to, but I should spell this out. You should all be so lucky as to be invited to Sundance, but if you are, sometimes screening sequence plays a crucial role. Clerks played four times, as do all the films. Its first three screens were in a smaller screen, where, you know, a lot of demand built up. The fourth and final key screening that set the tone, made the deal happen on this film, was in the prestige large screen called the Egyptian Theater on a Friday afternoon. Perfect venue, perfect timing. The tone couldn't have been set better. We didn't schedule that; the festival did. I don't know if Bob Hawke helped to play a role in something one would call preferential treatment or not. I'd like to credit him because without Bob Hawke, maybe none of this ever happens. But that really did become a big part of why things, I think, in the end turned out so well. Also, since you've heard reference made to this yellow legal sheet, one-page deal memo, which also had David Lindy's blood from his nosebleed on it. And a shameless plug, I'm currently writing a book about the last decade called Spike, Mike, Slackers, and Dykes, dealing with a lot of these films that you've come to know and love. And in the appendix of the book will be a copy of that deal memo with the blood in red.
Yeah, that was we're sitting there, and David Lindy's talking to John about something about the deal and the print and Disney and their involvement. All of a sudden, David Lindy's nose just starts bleeding out of nowhere. And we never met the dude, but he's like, here's a suit from, like, a Hollywood company. And, like, he's bleeding out his nose. We're like, he's cokey. But
altitude.
And he kept saying altitude. And it's so funny, he's sitting there going, John, perpetuity lasts about 25 years in the United States. He's got all these cloth napkins to his face. And then he just starts bleeding on our contract. We thought it was all over. We're like, shit, that's a deal breaker, ain't it? But it was.
Okay, so after Sundance, which prize did you win at Sundance?
Filmmaker Trophy.
You started on the festival circuit, and my impression, and you know, I don't have the exact numbers here, but is that Clerks has been to more festivals than almost any film in history, and Scott and Kevin have followed it, have been with it, and doing great Q&As all around the world. But go specifically to the Cannes Film Festival and just tell us a little bit about that experience and how it ended up, and then the legendary call to John.
Oh, holy shit. Cannes was kind of cool, and it was where the moment we got off the plane, I'd never been anywhere in my life. We'd just gotten back from Japan with Tokyo Sundance, so that we thought that was up. When we got to Cannes, like, they treat you really well. And the minute we sat down, they started us on this interview track, which lasted the whole week, and we got to see Pulp Fiction, which was a big highlight. And at the end of the week, I won an award, or the film won an award, and I was elated, you know, I was like, wow, we won an award in Cannes, and it was called the Prix de la Jeunesse. And it's a prize given out by a jury of 20-somethings, they give it to their favorite film. And later in the day, we'd win the Critics Week Award, which was a cash prize. It didn't come with a trophy, but it came with a check. I would have rather had a trophy. But we win that first prize in the morning. I'm like, God, this is great. I won in Cannes. Who am I going to call? So I'm like, I'll call Pearson. So I call up Pearson. I'm like, John, we won the Prix de la Jeunesse. And he's going, yeah, it's kind of nice. Spike won that. He referred to it as the booby prize. And I was just like, Dad? But it wasn't my father.
Twice that word.
So it was here I am in France, and I'm holding this trophy in one hand and the phone in the other, and I was going to throw one or the other after I heard that, but he's just like, well, it's not going to help your domestic box office, but, you know, what the hell, it's nice, right? And I was like, John, thanks, I got to go.
So then you just kept going to festivals and having good screenings. I mean, was there any sort of sense as you went along how the film would play overseas, how it played in foreign languages, how it played subtitled or not subtitled, things like that?
Well, it was kind of weird.
I'll get to that. I have a little tidbit to add there.
Mark's got a tidbit. Everyone told us, like, this is a film that won't play. First, when we made it, everyone's like, this film won't play outside of Leonardo. And then it became like, this film won't play outside of New Jersey. And then it was like, this film won't play outside the United States, particularly the East Coast. Then it just became the United States. And then when the film actually went outside to play, it's like, went outside to play, that sounds funny. When the film played outside of the United States, it was bizarre because, like, the French were like, yeah, we get it. They got into it. It's not like it was so foreign to them, because I just think everyone's had a shitty job, so they kind of identify with it. So we were just surprised when the film, like, when the foreign sales kicked in and stuff. We were just so indoctrinated to this fact that the film would never make any money overseas, that when it did, you know, it was quite pleasant. And more so than it made money, it's just like people got it outside the United States. That was nice.
It's a really important point, and credit to David Lindy, who we shouldn't just identify as the guy with a nosebleed. He swore at that table that night in Sundance that he was going to make this film work foreign, and I was skeptical. I think, you know, again, Kevin's right, there was a lot of skepticism in the air in general, and he did. I mean, the film had, it turned out to play great, but that could still just be a festival thing. But David's managed to parlay that into really excellent foreign sales, and I guess I'm not comfortable putting a number on that yet, but it's kind of an astounding number on the foreign sales category on Clerks.
See, by this point, I'd seen the movie in so many different incarnations, from the long version on tape with the killing at the end. We showed it in New Directors, New Films with the 16mm print, which was remixed by that point and trimmed down, but not really in the best of shape. By the time the movie played in Cannes, it was a 35mm print that I actually was surprised to find that on my 10th screening of the film had picked up a line that I hadn't heard before. And the progression of the movie was a great example of what a blow-up and remix can really do for a movie. But I noticed that screening, because it was subtitled for the French audiences, knowing, you know, where the comic beats were in the film, how people reading the subtitles were laughing before the line was delivered. And so it wasn't surprising to hear that, you know, it was like, oh, there's a lot of vernacular or slang or whatever you want to call it, and it seemed to, whoever did the translation either contributed to it in their own way or really got to the essence of the film. But on the way out, I was introduced to John Waters, who had a Serial Mom playing as special screening, and he really loved the movie, and he turned, and at one point he goes, I can't believe there's another movie in the Cannes Film Festival of selections that mentions chicks with dicks. And so...
So I got that going for me.
By the way, something else happened at Sundance, which is an indication of where Kevin and Scott are coming from. There's this infamous, what I call the first half hour. Everybody else says 20 minutes, but maybe it just seemed like a half hour to me.
No, it's getting longer.
But after the first screening at Sundance, Kevin and or Scott said, Haitley, this drags. We've got to cut it. And that willingness to trim it down without being asked to by the distributor was just an indication of where they're coming from.
That's a great point. I mean, again, Miramax often gets accused of being quick with the scissors. I think that Kevin and Scott had their notes. By the time Sundance was over, I think you had notes for 10 minutes worth of cuts right there and then. Mm-hmm. You had another couple of minutes to go, but that was entirely on your own.
Okay, we're going to open it up to questions from the audience now. If you'd like to head over to that mic, it would be helpful. Someone there?
I'd like to speak to John and Mark about soundtracks. Soundtracks give small films a big crossover potential. We have a work in progress here, and we have all our finishing funds in place. We're in production right now. We'll be done in about a month and a half. So a big variable for us is the soundtrack and how much we're going to invest in it. We secured an excellent composer, Barry Coffing, who's got an Emmy nomination. But right now the biggest variable for us is how much money do we put into it and how much we can expect to get out of it. And I'd like to know your involvement in that type of situation, John, and how you think, I'm asking how much you think we can gamble, what do you think we can expect to get out of it, and...
I'd like it if we could keep the questions pretty much to Clerks. And if you want to, I mean, I'm not saying we won't get an answer to your question, but for other people, we could, afterwards, you can get one-on-one, you know, about individual projects. So.
Thank you.
No, I mean, I'll answer you quickly. I've had pretty much back-to-back experiences, a terrible experience ultimately on way too much money being spent on the Atlantic Records soundtrack to Amongst Friends, which basically cost the deferment holders on that film about $350,000 that they would have in their pockets otherwise right now. On Clerks, it's too soon to tell. I mean, Sony's really geared up. There's a lead track, and you know, Kevin, I guess you're about to shoot the video.
Yeah.
Soul Asylum's written a song for the film, and the video. Go ahead, speak a bit about your current day soundtrack on the movie.
It's really good. Sony liked the movie enough, and they started showing it to some of their artists, and the artists decided to like give in songs for the soundtrack. It's got an incredibly low budget on the soundtrack, but it's a $1 zillion soundtrack for a $27,000 movie. And that's kind of like what we got it for. So it's just nice that a lot of people threw their weight behind it, and we kept some of the songs that were originally there, so it still has the same feel. It's good. I like the soundtrack. Not to be a commercial or anything, but it is pretty good.
That happened after the fact, though, obviously, with Miramax totally behind it. I mean, if you're talking about being a producer working independently now, I mean, you're clearly in a totally different situation.
Other questions?
Given your cynical comments, John Pearson, sorry, given your cynical comments...
I think they were cynical. I think they're really heartfelt. I do have some problems, and I don't mind speaking them out loud, because I don't know how this market really works for all of you here now, but they were not meant to be cynical.
No, I appreciate your honesty, seriously, and I think everybody does. Do you think it worked in Kevin's favor that he didn't send a copy of the film to you prior to, you actually seeing it at festivals?
I think I would have watched Close the same way any time I saw it. I think I can say that. Completely honestly, I don't think there would have been any change if I'd seen it in August, September, October, or November.
Okay, and Kevin, had you any idea that you were speaking to those underlying ideas that Bob was feeling while writing Clerks? Do you recall those?
You want the lie or the truth?
The truth, yeah.
Both? The lie? Well, I really wanted to get to the inner child and all of
that. No, the truth.
Especially, and I know everyone has a need, and I was speaking to that need. The truth, no. I mean, the film's going to affect a lot of people in different ways. Thankfully, it affected Bob that way. Some people it affects where they get up in the first 5 minutes and they're like, oh, it's perversity. How does this guy get to make a movie? But some people, like my parents, it just goes right over their heads. Some people like us, we find it amusing. Some people find it laugh out loud funny. It's going to hit everybody in a different way. Most everyone will wind up especially an IFFM crowd is going to look at it and go that son of a bitch can make a movie. I can make a movie. So, it's going to affect everybody in a different way.
Okay, thanks.
I guess this is for Kevin and Scott. How does it feel after all this hard work and everything to have the MPAA come down and give you an NC-17? And how much do you think it's going to hurt your domestic distribution possibilities? And will Mark, maybe this is a question for Miramax, is there ever going to come to a point where a company or a distributor can really stand up against Jack Valenti and try to get this system changed? Because it probably is going to hurt you guys, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Because it's not a film that would be easy to cut. I mean, at this point, what little plot there is in it, once you start taking out chunks, there's nothing but a short film. But Miramax has hired Alan Dershowitz. So, we're going to stand behind him and look kind of weepy and see if they'll change the appeal.
What happens, if you don't win on appeal, what happens? You just have to live with it?
Well, it's been a bizarre case because they haven't, the MPA, I don't know if it's normal, I don't know if it's just this example or maybe lately, but they don't tell you what the problem is. So what you have to do is start making cuts and then submitting and resubmitting. And the problem with Clerks is that it's all dialogue. There's no nudity, there's no violence. So if there's cuts to be made, it's dialogue cuts, and that's where what very little plot there is in. It's in the dialogue. So you start toying with the structure.
Can you take it out unrated, or is it too late since you already went?
We in our contract, we promised an R-rated film. We deliver an R-rated film. Because, we never thought NC-17, it's been seen at so many different festivals, nobody ever said, oh, my God, this is groundbreaking in terms of its vulgarity level. It just never occurred to us as an NC-17 film.
Okay, thanks.
Hi. You alluded to some things that were done after the Miramax deal in terms of the soundtrack and cutting. I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the process and whether everything was smooth or did you do reshoots and how much extra money, you don't have to give figures, but maybe an idea you put in after the distribution deal.
Well, we never reshot anything. And as far as the sound quality, it turned out the first time we... went from Magstock. We did a digital mix of this film because it was the only thing we wanted to spend money on was the sound quality since it's all dialogue. And when they were relaying it into the digital system, dropping it into the system, the machine that they were playing it over, one of the heads was dirty. One was clean, one was dirty. So, like, one of the tracks sometimes sound clear, and sometimes it sounds like you're speaking with a hand in front of your mouth, like that. So the first time when we started watching the film, we just grew accustomed to it and never occurred to us. When we actually went to make a 16mm print for new directors, new films, because we made cuts in the film, we had to make a new, Jesus, Mark, keep it together. The first time we made the cuts and they were putting just relaying the sound again, it's like suddenly it was clear and we were like, what the hell happened? And they figured out it was like the dirty heads. So we never, like, spend money boosting it up or, like, looping. Actually, we had to loop one tiny thing the other week. We sang a Wrangler song in it, and Wrangler wouldn't let us use the song for some reason, which blows my mind, because Wrangler, man, when was the last time they sold a pair of jeans in this goddamn country? You'd think they could use the advertisement. But we didn't spend, like, a lot of money in that kind of department. Where we spent the money was blowing the thing up to 35. That was, like, a huge chunk of cash. And parking. Parking in this goddamn city is so expensive. Most of our post-production budget went to that.
Any other questions? Well, if not, I want to thank our panelists for being so candid and wish them luck.
Yeah.